From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. President Donald Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gave their first joint press conference in Washington today, notably before the two leaders sat down to private talks. They were asked about the prospects for Middle East peace, including a two-state solution. Netanyahu pushed those questions aside, saying he'd rather deal with what he called issues of substance, such as his stated prerequisites for peace, rather than labels. Here's what Trump said.
So I'm looking at two state and one state, and I like the one that both parties like. I'm very happy with the one that both parties like. I can live with either one.
Joining us now with some analysis is Domenico Montanaro, NPR politics editor. Hi there, Domenico.
Hey there.
So in a minute, we'll talk about what all the domestic press corps wants to talk about, which is Russia and the Trump campaign. But let's stay focused here on discussions that the two leaders had regarding prospects for Middle East peace. What did you make of what the prime minister and the president had to say?
Well, this is a remarkable shift for an American president to move away from the two-state solution. You know, Donald Trump did not rule out the two-state solution, but as you heard there in that clip, certainly open to it not even being on the table. He said two-state, one-state, whatever either party likes. And you could hear Benjamin Netanyahu laughing there in the background. Clearly, Israel at this point is getting everything it wants. And the United States is now moving away from its normal role as the objective deal maker with the two-state solution at the heart of what the U.S. believes can lead to peace in the Middle East.
Interesting. And we heard some points of friction, though, in the press conference. For example, when the president said he'd like to see Israel take a little pause from construction of new settlements, how did Prime Minister Netanyahu react to that?
Again, kind of jokingly,
yeah.
And, pushed that aside and said, well, you know, we'll talk kind of thing. And it wasn't at the heart of the issue, really, when it came to Mideast peace. So, you know, that is certainly not something that there wasn't much give from Netanyahu on any of these issues. You know, the only place where you could hear a little bit of give is when you heard Donald Trump say both sides are going to have to give something. And he said, you know that, right? And Netanyahu said, both sides.
Well, of course, the controversy currently surrounding the administration about reports from the New York Times that senior Trump campaign officials had repeated contacts with Russian intelligence officials. That did come up in today's press conference. So did what happened to General Michael Flynn. And here's what Trump had to say about that. He called Flynn a wonderful man.
Papers are being leaked. Things are being leaked. It's criminal action, criminal act. And it's been going on for a long time before me. But now it's really going on. And people are trying to cover up for a terrible loss that the Democrats had under Hillary Clinton.
So, Domenico, how did the president handle this moment?
I don't really understand what's going on here, because you heard yesterday Sean Spicer go to the press briefing room and thunder that Michael Flynn had an eroding level of trust with the president. That's why the president asked for his resignation quite assuredly. You had the day before Kellyanne Conway, one of Trump's advisors, saying that Flynn had the full confidence of President Trump. Yet you have Donald Trump again today sounding a little bit more meek when it came to Flynn. He didn't say he misled, he's out. He was instead more upset about the leaks. And he echoed his own tweets from this morning, talking about the leaks being illegal, that these are criminal acts. He blasted the intelligence community. But Donald Trump has known since January 26th, according to our reporting, that Michael Flynn misrepresented the nature of his conversation with Vice President Pence and with other administration officials, including Sean Spicer, the White House press secretary, that he did not discuss sanctions. He did discuss those sanctions, and they've known for 3 weeks. And the only reason that he's out, it appears today, is because that became public.
Well, that's Domenico Montanaro, NPR politics editor, bringing us up to speed on the press conference held today between President Donald Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Domenico, thanks very much.
Always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
So as we just heard, President Trump said Michael Flynn was being treated unfairly. Trump talked about leaks, but the intelligence community is concerned about what Flynn allegedly said in phone calls with the Russian ambassador to the United States. Let's bring in Greg Miller, national security correspondent for The Washington Post, one of the reporters who's been breaking this story. And Greg, you write now that one of the things that really spooked, well, the spooks, you know, the intelligence agencies, is that Flynn's calls with the Russian ambassador were simultaneous with the discovery that the Russians were trying to influence the U.S. election.
Yeah, I mean, that's why there's this broader context here. So the Flynn narrative fits into this bigger story about all of this swirling suspicion about Russia's interference in the election, Russia's ties with the Trump campaign. The Flynn call comes at this really critical moment, which is why it gets so much scrutiny. The day that Obama is announcing sanctions to punish Russia for this unprecedented interference in the U.S. election, Flynn is having a conversation with the Russian ambassador in which he's sort of signaling, don't worry about this too much. We're going to be in place soon to deal with it. And that's why it's a pretty big deal.
And for those, the cynics who say, well, wait a second. I mean, what's the harm in an incoming administration saying, don't worry, you know, if they have a different opinion about sanctions, saying to a country, you know, don't worry, we'll handle that. It's illegal.
It's illegal. It is in violation of a law that dates to 1799 and has never been enforced, but nevertheless is a law. And it's also just highly problematic for sort of obvious reasons. I mean, the U.S. government is supposed to speak with one voice, even in a transition period between administrations. To have an unauthorized person sending signals not to worry about what this outgoing administration is doing, is that person operating with the interests of Washington, D.C. and the U.S. government or in Moscow's interests at that point?
Michael Flynn has been in intelligence circles for a long time now. In fact, he made a trip to Russia in 2013 as part of a U.S. intelligence team. He must have known that the Russian ambassador to the U.S. is being tapped by intelligence people here. How could he make those calls knowing that?
Well, there's a couple of possibilities here. One is something that we always hear from counterterrorism officials, that even though it's just sort of abundantly known that even in terrorist organizations overseas, the U.S. is intercepting signals everywhere, they still slip. They forget. They are so accustomed to speaking freely on the phone that when a subject comes up they shouldn't talk about, they forget that they shouldn't go there and just sort of trip over that line. Maybe that's what happens here. I mean, it's hard to know, but you're right. Mm-hmm. Flynn absolutely should be acutely aware of how pervasive U.S. intelligence collection is. He would have seen some of the most sensitive intelligence, a lot of it drawn from the intercepted communications of people like the Russian ambassador.
Everybody was puzzled after President Obama announced the sanctions against Russia for its interference in the election, sending some Russian officials home, et cetera. And then people were surprised at Putin's seeming shrugging response. Are you saying it's because Putin knew that those sanctions weren't going to hold?
I mean, it's a huge question. It was a baffling response to people in Washington. For decades of history, there have been lots of cases of U.S. and Russia retaliating, you know, expelling one another's spies and diplomats or imposing sanctions. It's almost always reciprocal. It's almost always balanced. And in this case, Putin almost ignores it and, in fact, sort of extends an olive branch. Why don't you Americans here in Moscow come to the Kremlin for our holiday festivities? You know, we should all get along and get past these petty differences. It just catches everybody by off guard so much that that's what really triggers a renewed effort to look at, well, what explains this? Why does he do this? That's when the White House, when the CIA and FBI really start to revisit those communications between Flynn and Kislyak.
And tell us more about what we know about how intelligence officials debated informing the Trump campaign that this was happening. Because some were worried that, first of all, Russia had this information and could blackmail Flynn, but also that Pence was being set up.
Yeah. So throughout the month of January, there are these debates unfolding inside the Obama administration and in particular in the upper realms of the national security agencies, including FBI, CIA, and the Director of National Intelligence. They know they got to tell Obama. The question for them is, do we also tell Trump? If so, when? And for a while, the FBI Director Comey is saying, no, can't do that, can't take that step yet. we're still looking at this, we're still investigating this. That all changes as they see the Trump transition team at the time publicly saying things that U.S. intelligence agencies know not to be true.
Yeah. Well, do we know how much then-President-elect Trump had input into these phone calls? For instance, do we know if Flynn was saying to the ambassador, let me check with Trump on that? Or, do we know?
Yeah, that's one of the big looming questions, and the answer, and we do not know the answer to it yet. I mean, that's a very critical question. I mean, that would be a huge deal, obviously, if Flynn comes out of this call, calls the boss and says, yeah, we talked about sanctions, because that would suggest that Trump knew well before Justice Department brought this to the Trump administration's attention. But that's just speculative at this point. We don't know that to be the case.
That's Greg Miller, national security correspondent for The Washington Post. Greg, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's take a little break from the news and escape into Christina's world, Andrew Wyeth's 1948 painting of a woman stretched out on the grass in a pale pink house dress, turning away from us and toward a house up on a hill that is, what, haunted or a refuge? Is she young or is she old? Is she pretty? For years, Christina was a staple on dorm room walls, along with Wyeth's tattered lace blowing through a window. And we learned both were real. Christina Olson, a neighbor of Wyeth's in Maine, was 55 when he painted her, her body contorted by a neurological disease, her face worn and hardened. By what? Best-selling author Christina Baker Klein takes that up in her new novel, A Piece of the World. She joins us now. And Christina, your family moved to Maine and like many, loved this painting.
So I believe that we actually trespassed and had a picnic in the spot where Christina sat in the painting. I have a photograph from that visit when I was young. And then a little bit later, my father bought a woodcut for me made by a local artist. It wasn't copying Christina's world, but it was the same kind of image. It was definitely an homage. And my father gave it to me and said, this is to remind you of our visit, but also the girl reminds me of you. So I kind of had this connection to the painting. One other thing I just want to say about that is that my grandmother, Christina, was born within a decade of Christina Olson, grew up in a clabbered farmhouse very similar to hers, had polio, and had no electricity or running water or any modern amenities. So I had grown up hearing her stories, and I very much, when I started doing research for this book, drew on my memories of that.
Wow. Safe to say you are the right person to have written this book. And it's funny because you mentioned your family's visit to the house, and you kind of make fun of the people, maybe your family as well, who would come in the novel. You have people drive up to try to find Andrew Wyeth, this new artist that they're hearing about. Take us back. Christina Olson, the real person. What a legacy her family had. One side descended from a magistrate in the Salem witch trials. Tell us more about who she really was.
Her family was a prominent New England family. She's descended from the presiding judge of the Salem witch trials, the only judge who never recounted, whose name was Hathorne.
Her family's so shamed by that they sort of changed the spelling and fled to Maine.
They fled to Maine, and then another part of the family, Nathaniel Hawthorne, also changed the spelling, left Salem, and spent the rest of his life essentially obsessively reworking the stories of people like his relative. There was a curse on the family. As a witch stood at the scaffold, she said, may God put a curse on the family of John Hathorne. And so in Christina Olson's world, in real life, they lived with this curse. And they really believed, in a way, in those witches. And in fact, Christina's grandmother kept the door open between the shed and the kitchen for the witches to come and go.
Well, and it's so wonderfully informative because Wyeth's paintings seem bewitched and seemed haunted. And he must have known of this history of her family. And suddenly that house on the hill that she's reaching towards does feel more haunting. But so many things haunt her. She has this degenerative disease. It's believed to be, is it Charcot-Marie-Tooth? It's a neurological disease.
It is. In fact, I went to the International Neurology Convention a few years ago to hear a Harvard professor who gave a paper on this disease and on Christina Olson in particular. It was so helpful.
Ah. Well, people thought it was Charcot-Marie-Tooth, but it was never diagnosed. But she slowly, as you tell her story, we watch her as a young teenager and then growing older, be terribly affected by this to the point where she was crawling, pulling herself to the gravestones to see her family, to go visit someone. She would be pulling herself by her arms. Did that really happen?
It really happened often. She was so proud. Her father was in a wheelchair. No one has ever said this, but I actually believe that he also had Charcot-Marie-Tooth. He was in a wheelchair for the last 15 years of his life. Christina took a different path. She didn't want to be in a wheelchair, and she felt that her father was sort of weak for having chosen that. She did pull herself around, and she would go visit her dear friend Sadie across the field by pulling herself along. And I think Sadie treated her like anyone else. And it was a normalizing experience for her, gave her autonomy. And I think she never really felt that she was at a disadvantage in doing so.
Did she really have this other disappointment in her life that you work into the book? Did a young man court her and then leave her?
Everything in the book is factually accurate.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
So I found a book by Jean Brooks Olsen, the niece of Christina. It's a biography of Christina. And it was so, reading between the lines of the real life story, devastating in her life because she didn't have many options. She lived alone on the coast of Maine with her brother, very much sort of a solitary person. And this was her one chance at love. And when that was gone, her life felt dark for a while. And then Wyeth came into it and brought color again.
Oh. Well, and you introduce us to this young Wyeth who meets her through his wife, Betsy, who summered in the area. And he sees immediately the character in her face in this old house. I'm reading from your note. He said, "The world of New England is in that house, spidery, like crackling skeletons rotting in the attic, dry bones. It's like a tombstone to sailors lost at sea. The Olsen ancestor who fell from the yardarm of a square rigger and was never found."
Not a great quote.
"Yes, it's the doorway of the sea to me, of mussels and clams and sea monsters and whales. There's a haunting feeling there of people coming back to a place." We mentioned the witches. Also on her father's side, her mother, the Hathorne, married a Swedish sailor who was washed up literally on shore. Sure. So he describes perfectly this house that you then tell us about. What are some of the other details that you worked in?
Well, you know, one of the most interesting aspects of telling a story about real people when you're writing a novel is that a lot of times real people don't behave the way a novelist might choose. And so Christina did things that felt inscrutable to me, and I had to create motivations for them. Like, I'll give you an example. When she was three, she had this virus, and it led to this degenerative disease. They didn't know what it was. They didn't know how to treat it. And so her father was going to take her to Rockland. He did take her to Rockland in a horse and buggy in the winter. It was a long journey. And when they got to Rockland, this little girl who was younger than 10 refused to go. And her father, who by all accounts was strong-willed and very sort of imposing, was cowed and took her home without seeing the doctor that they had come to see. That, it was hard to believe.
She became like the main landscape.
Like slate.
Like slate in some ways. Well, we know what's coming at the end of your book. We know Andrew Wyeth is going to paint Christina's world and Christina. What did your research tell you about how that came to be?
Some people said that Wyeth painted her secretly from a room upstairs, but that she never knew. More definitive sources say that she did know that he sketched her in the grass, although not down in the grass way at the bottom of the field as she appears in the painting, but instead just outside the back door. And I came to believe that that actually is what happened. I think he did sketch her, and he took all these sketches and took them upstairs. Right. My task at the end of the book was to make you, the reader, understand kind of how the painting brings her whole life together for her. I wanted it to be a revelation both to the reader and to Christina that this painting, which we now recognize as an iconic American painting, even a masterpiece, was very special, and that it gave her agency in a way that she hadn't had it before. It allowed her to be truly seen by someone. And even though the woman in the painting doesn't look exactly the way Christina looked at that point. I believe that Christina felt, and Wyeth too, felt that he had captured her essence in it.
That's Christina Baker Klein. Her new book about Christina Olson, The Woman in Andrew Wyeth's Christina's World, is a piece of the world. Christina Baker Klein, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Well, as luck would have it, we know what Andrew Wyeth was thinking when he painted Christina. I was lucky enough to have a rare conversation with the late artist in the 1980s. In this portion, he spoke of how his realism often wasn't real.
I'm not completely honest, even my work. I mean, my subjects are fleeting things. Sometimes they don't even exist.
But Christina does.
Oh, she did. Yes. But she was never in the field, for instance.
There you have it. Andrew Wyeth painted Christina Olson into that field.
This is what she wanted to be. People were finally bothered that I painted her face, and they found that she was rather a very powerful-looking woman that we wouldn't call obviously beautiful. I thought she was. And I probably it was a mistake, because people had many ideas of that she would look like Emily Dickinson, you know, or something. People love to have their own imagination.
And more recently, we asked Andrew's son, Jamie Wyeth, did his father put Christina where she wanted to be?
Exactly. She had, in fact, gone back and forth. The family graveyard was the Olson family graveyard, so she would drag herself occasionally back and forth, but he never really saw her doing it. But I think he became so close to her, and people bring their own stories to bear. That painting is so popular, and I think people imagine it's a young girl sort of lost. Well, that's wonderful. I mean, if that's their accessibility to it, terrific.
The Wyeths commenting on Christina Olson, the inspiration for Christina Baker Klein's new novel, A Piece of the World.
This podcast and the following message are made possible by The Economist. From politics to business and finance, from science and technology to the arts, readers are brought clear analysis of the issues that lie behind each week's global news stories. The Economist's content satisfies the globally curious with a distilled view of world affairs that is intelligent, insightful, and thought-provoking. Sign up for an introductory offer at economist.com/now.
Two Senate Democrats are trying to get answers about what kind of mobile device Donald Trump is using. Senators Tom Carper and Claire McCaskill sent a letter to the Secretary of Defense, which became public this week. They want to know if President Trump is using an unsecured phone. If that's the case, they write, the national security risks are considerable. CNN's Samuel Burke has been looking at all of this. He joins us from New York. And, you know, Sam, the first thought you have is, after Hillary Clinton's emails, have we learned nothing? So clarify for us. First of all, what's an unsecured phone? What's a secured phone?
Well, basically, we have to say what we know here. CNN has confirmed that Donald Trump, as recently as this week, and continues using his old Android phone. But what the White House won't answer is whether that phone has been secured or not. And what that means is that you'd likely have to get rid of that old Android phone and replace it with something else that's been secured, which would have few functions and as few apps as possible, because the more apps you have, that means the more possibility you have of being hacked, and likely only being able to call about a dozen people is what having a secure phone means. Remember, you're only as safe as the other people that you're calling, emailing, or texting. And as you remember, a lot of Hillary Clinton contacts found that out the hard way
right.
during the election.
Well, but you mentioned that. What about Twitter? I mean, this is a president that Twitter's around the clock. Can you make Twitter secure?
Well, the problem is that we don't know that the cell phone the problem really here is that a cell phone's camera and microphone can be hacked. Even security conscious Apple had an issue with this last year. And basically, the reason that people are so concerned is that if a phone, even if he's just using it for Twitter and no other reason, is if a phone is being used, for instance, like it was in Mar-a-Lago this weekend with the Japanese prime minister, can be used to listen in or eavesdrop.
Well, let's remind
be
people.
A major problem.
Let's remind people, we did a story on it, but the aides surrounding Donald Trump after North Korea's missile test was announced were using their phones to light up these secure documents that they were bringing
yes.
to the dinner table. So lots of security issues there. I mean, all the diners were watching this whole thing and taking pictures. But if somebody hacked one of those aides' phones, presumably they could take a picture right there.
And that might sound far-fetched to you or to me, but given the environment that we live in, given the elections that we just saw and the role that hacking played in that, it is not a stretch to think that somebody or some country could try to use the president's phone, the president of the United States, to hear what was going on during those meetings.
And we should say Donald Trump apparently doesn't use email. I remember early in the campaign, I don't think he uses a computer, but certainly is tweeting somewhere, probably off this phone. What has the White House said? We know he was given a secure smartphone recently, but does he use an unsecured Android phone as well? What does the White House say?
Well, this is what's so fascinating is the White House won't tell us, but there is a scenario where this all comes down to tweeting. It may be that he got a secure phone, and we know a lot of times they're very stripped down. They barely have any applications, and so it doesn't have Twitter on it, and he wants to keep on tweeting. And I think even Grandma and Grandpa know that Donald Trump is going to keep on tweeting no matter what. So this really could be a challenge, a good challenge for the NSA to create a smartphone for 2017 that's secure for the president and has Twitter.
I got news for you, young man. Grandma and Grandpa are also tweeting. That's CNN's Samuel Burke. Sam, thank you so much.
Thanks, Robin.
The Soviet Union fought a bloody, disastrous war in Afghanistan in the 1980s. But of course, today, when we think about Afghanistan, we think about how it's America's longest war. The U.S. has been in Afghanistan since 2001. However, Russia is also there.
It's of concern, shouldn't it be, to all of us that you now have Russia, Iran, and Al-Qaeda now playing significant roles, some one more than the other, but that wasn't the case a couple of years ago, was it?
That's Republican Senator John McCain during a recent hearing held by the Senate Armed Services Committee. He posed that question to General John Nicholson, the top U.S. commander in Afghanistan. Here's part of General Nicholson's response.
The Russian involvement this year has become more difficult. First, they have begun to publicly legitimize the Taliban. This narrative that they promote is that the Taliban are fighting Islamic State, and the Afghan government is not as fighting Islamic State, and that therefore there could be a spillover of this group into the region. This is a false narrative.
Nicholson didn't offer many details, but there are clear questions on how Russia's presence in Afghanistan complicates U.S. efforts there. Andrew Weiss is vice president for studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where he oversees research on Russia and Eurasia. He joins us from Washington. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks so much for having me.
So first of all, tell us, what do we know about why the Russians have a presence in Afghanistan now?
Well, I don't think we're talking so much about presence so much as we're talking about harassment and efforts by the Russians to undermine the United States and NATO-led military effort there. What we've seen in recent days, including this week, are the Russians trying to build a diplomatic profile on Afghanistan that basically circumvents what the U.S.-led effort is about and circumvents the government of Afghanistan itself.
Well, tell me more about that, though, because as General Nicholson pointed out in that tape, it seems as if the Russians are saying they're doing this, they're being involved in Afghanistan in a fight against ISIS.
So what they're doing is they're basically building bridges to the Taliban, the radical group which ruled Afghanistan before the U.S. military intervention in 2001. And they're trying to basically legitimize the Taliban. They seem to be doing that on the back of a false narrative, which is what General Nicholson was just talking about, which claims that the Taliban are the only serious group operating against Islamic State in Afghanistan. There are other indications of Russian intelligence sharing with the Taliban, which began at least starting in 2015. There's indications of Russian cross-border military activity and possibly some weapons being transferred from the Russian government to the Taliban. When Senator Nicholson was testifying the other day, he said he wouldn't talk about any of those issues in open session. So we're operating on the basis of press reports. The other thing which we're aware of is a Russian diplomatic offensive. This week, there's a big conference in Moscow. They've invited various regional stakeholders. They've excluded the United States and NATO from participating in that diplomatic exchange in Moscow.
Interesting. Well, the reason why we wanted to talk with you today is because earlier this week we spoke with Michael Kugelman from the Wilson Center, and he talked about how Russia may have some legitimate concerns about the security situation in Afghanistan. One of those concerns has to do with the drug trade. So let's listen to what he said.
Well, I mean, I think that there oftentimes in the United States is a tendency to have a very reflexive response to anything involving Russia, and that whatever Russia is doing must be bad. And, you know, I would contend that in Afghanistan, Russia has a very reasonable, it has a justification to want to be active and present in the country again. One is simply Russia has very genuine concerns about the implications of a prolonged security crisis in Afghanistan. For example, you know, the drug trade in Afghanistan is really flourishing, and it always does when the insurgency is strong, because the Taliban has a big part to do with it. You know, Russia has a pretty bad heroin epidemic, and it has reason to worry that that could worsen if you have more of these drugs coming into Russia, given the troubling situation in Afghanistan.
So, Andrew Weiss, respond to that.
No, there's no doubt that the drug trade, the flow of narcotics from that are grown in Afghanistan across this very porous border into Central Asia and then onward into drug markets in Russia, that's clearly a problem. But I think at the root of it is the United States and Russia are now acting like competing great powers and at times adversarial great powers. So when you see Russian planes buzzing U.S. military vessels in the Black Sea in recent days, you see the interference in our election, you see the attempts to undermine the U.S. image around the world as a bastion of democracy. This I would put in the same basket. It's you know, ankle biting. It's trying to undermine the U.S. military effort. For many years, the Russians were quite upset about the U.S. military presence on the territory of Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan, post-Soviet successor countries. They worked very hard to basically get us kicked out of those countries. And now that the United States is backing away from its long-term military commitment to Afghanistan, I think they're saying there's an opening here for Russian influence.
Okay, so this is very fascinating and perhaps even troubling, because to hear you say that the U.S. And Russia especially are posturing here around Afghanistan, are we verging towards a replay of history here? Because the Soviet Union, you know, fought a bloody and disastrous war in Afghanistan in the 1980s, which in part gave rise to the Taliban.
I think the Russian government is unlikely to, as they say in Russian, step into that river twice. But what we are seeing, I think, is a revival of Cold War-style thinking. There was a great interview the other day in TASS, the Russian state news agency, with their main envoy for Afghanistan. And in this interview, Ambassador Kabulov really portrays the entire question of the U.S. presence in Afghanistan in Cold War terms. He talks about how the U.S. used to have these big bases in Iran. We got kicked out of Iran after the revolution. We then seized on Afghanistan as a pivot point to project influence toward the Middle East, toward China, Pakistan, and Russia. And he sort of talks about, you know, we lived through the Cold War. We know what this is all about. And there's this kind of, really larding it quite darkly in terms of big geopolitical great game competition. I think that kind of talk is a reflection of what Russian policy is all about, which is if they can do things to squeeze out the United States or to make the U.S. lose, that's got to be good for Russia. I think that's a misguided way to think about a problem as complex as Afghanistan, but it clearly holds a lot of sway at senior levels in the Russian government.
So let's talk about for a moment then how this complicates the U.S. mission in Afghanistan, because of course, in that testimony that General Nicholson gave, he was there to ask for more troops. I mean, the United States is at yet another one of those pivot points regarding how to move forward in achieving some kind of security in Afghanistan. Does this Russian involvement there make it that much more difficult?
You'd have to talk to somebody who's following Afghanistan more closely than I do to understand exactly how much the political challenge facing the U.S. and the Congress right now, particularly the Trump administration, in lobbying for greater military role inside Afghanistan is affected by the Russian initiative. My sense is that's probably a second-order factor, but I'm not an expert on that issue. I think what I would focus more on is that the United States is doing things militarily, diplomatically, and politically inside Afghanistan, and having this Russian role is just simply unhelpful. So it's more, I think, a question of it being eroding some of the political processes that we're trying to promote. For example, there was a peace initiative that basically involved the government in Kabul making amends and trying to get a group led by one of the warlords, Hekmatyar, taken off a UN sanctions list. Basically, for mischief-making purposes, the Russians intervened and basically said, no, we're not so sure that makes sense right now. And it undermined an attempt to promote reconciliation within Afghanistan. So I'd put most of what we're seeing in the the category of harassment and attempts to disrupt what the United States and the government in Kabul are doing, rather than an attempt to actually insert Russia directly back into this conflict.
I see. Do you believe that Russia is seeing some success with these attempts at harassment, though?
Yeah. No, I'm sure. I mean, as Nicholson said in his testimony last week, the war is at a stalemate. So I think when you're in a situation like that, any effort by the Russians to basically undermine what the United States is doing is a net negative, both for us and I think most tragically for the people of Afghanistan.
Well, Andrew Weiss is Vice President for Studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and he oversees research on Russia and Eurasia. Many thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
In El Cajon, California, near San Diego, hundreds of young soccer players from around the world are training, perfecting the art of the back pass, the header. They are from around the world, but all of them live in the U.S. All are refugees. And soccer is a means to an end, creating better students. From Here and Now contributor KQED, Aaron Siegel McIntyre explains.
Every Sunday morning, a transformation happens here on the basketball courts outside Cajon Valley Middle School. These concrete slabs surrounded by chain-link fence become the hallowed stomping ground for some of the most resilient soccer players ever to set foot in California. Osama Abdulaziz is one of those soccer-obsessed teens. He's 14 now, but he came to California from Iraq when he was 10. Today, he's not thinking about being a refugee. Right now, his mind is on one thing. Soccer. He's really, really excited to be playing.
See that number 11 in the white shirt? Andy, I think he's known for his speed. Fadi, the guy in the red, for his defending. He's fast too. Cyrus, that huge kid, he's good at everything.
These Sunday morning sessions are pickup games. Boys and girls play together on the same team. Kids here are from places like Congo, Sri Lanka, Pakistan, Colombia, Syria, and Afghanistan. A potent blend of sport and study helps these scholar athletes on and off the field through a group called YALA. YALA means let's go in Arabic. The nonprofit program is funded through private donations and some government grants. Sarah Cooper is YALA's director.
So we use soccer as a hook to entice children to come in and get academic.
Here at YALA, you can't participate in soccer unless you're in mandatory after-school tutoring. Part of that is ESL, and college is the goal. YALA's headquarters are a stucco building in downtown El Cajon that used to house a bank. Through tutoring and soccer, YALA helps immigrant and refugee kids excel emotionally, academically, and of course, on the soccer field. In the 8 years since its founding, 1,500 kids have gone through the program.
Oh, do you know what this property is called? Commutative property of multiplication. All right. See if you can.
Each kid coming here after school retrieves a Chromebook laptop, cracks it open, and gets focused.
A month in, I came to the U.S. I was struggling in school. I didn't speak a lot of English. I had like two friends.
Those two friends, he says, changed his life by introducing him to YALA.
I have a lot of family back in Iraq. The hard thing was when I came here, I didn't have any family. YALA really blessed me, and I'm thankful for that. I'm very, very thankful for that.
During afternoon study sessions, volunteers float around the room, helping out where needed.
5 times 4 is 20.
Yeah, so then what number is in common?
One of the volunteers, Patrick Foley, says he started volunteering as a response to Donald Trump's campaign rhetoric about immigrants.
The campaign of xenophobia and racism was one that I wanted to respond to, and the only thing I could think of to do something constructive was to volunteer here so the students understand that is not my America.
San Diego County's been a hotspot for refugee resettlement for decades. More than 14,000 Iraqi refugees have been resettled here over the last 8 years, and it's estimated that Iraqi Americans make up a third of El Cajon's population. About 40% of the scholar athletes at YALA are Iraqi. So is Zainab Salih, who supervises tutors here.
YALA, Jonathan.
Jonathan, YALA.
Let's go.
Oh, we did
okay,
it!
Okay, Sayaha is... Okay, there's no dots. There's no dots. Jonathan, Fayaha,
many younger no kids dots. At YALA, she says, don't remember much about their home countries.
They are American. They have no idea what about Iraq. The old one, yes, they have a story. They still remember the violence, the bombs, the blood. Sometimes when they start talking, you feel the pain in their voice and in their eyes.
What's my password?
Okay, it's in your folder. Can you check your folder, please?
Most recently, she says staff and volunteers at Yala have been wrestling with anti-immigrant rhetoric. But, she says,
we got to believe in our president and try to adapt. Maybe he don't see the good about our faith and our being immigrants right now, but I believe if we approve that, he going to see the goodness.
Back at the pickup game, Osama says playing soccer at Yala has given him a sense of belonging and taught him about resolving conflict.
We get into arguments, but at the end of the day, it's all competitive, and at the end, we're all one big family. It's like when you play on the same team, that just everything goes away. You automatically unite again. It's amazing. But I think soccer is the best way to solve problems.
For Here and Now, I'm Erin Siegel McIntyre.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.